I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Reagan Moya Jones, co-founder of Aiden NNA, a company that sells muslin swaddle blankets for babies. Swaddling, which means wrapping a baby firmly in a blanket, is designed to increase the length and quality of a baby's sleep. The practice has existed for thousands of years, and Reagan was swaddled as a baby in Australia in the 1960s. She started the company in 2004 after she was unable to find muslin wraps for her newborn child in the United States. Welcome.
Thank you.
What exactly is muslin?
Muslin is actually, it's 100% cotton, and muslin refers to the type of weave, which is an open weave which allows air to sort of flow through the fabric, which is what makes it ideal for, you know, baby products and primarily swaddling blankets.
I think of muslin as almost like cheesecloth.
Right. Well, that's interesting you say that, because when we first started the company, we weren't pre-washing the muslin. And I think Americans, not being familiar with it, were confused, because when you do feel it initially, it does feel like cardboard. It's quite scratchy, and why would you put something like that on your baby? But once you wash muslin, it gets very soft and fluffy, and, you know, that's, you know, why it makes an ideal baby blanket.
Talk to me about the history of swaddling.
Well, it dates back thousands of years. And actually, the book that I wrote, Swaddle Love, I wrote that because there is an interesting history in swaddling and, you know, why you do it. And we actually found quotes when I was writing the book that, you know, date back to biblical times, where, you know, throughout history there are quotes about, you know, babies, kings, queens, Jesus being swaddled. So it goes back a long, long way.
And it wasn't just babies being swaddled in muslin wraps. It was also the dead being swaddled in muslin
wraps. That's right. Yeah, we tended to try and leave that out, because I thought a book about babies and swaddling and dead people was not a good combination. But yes, that is absolutely true.
Why was swaddling, or swaddling in muslin wraps at least, unknown in the United States until recently?
Well, I think swaddling itself had been on hiatus in the United States, and I really couldn't tell you why that was. It's definitely started to come back into vogue, so to speak. Harvey Karp, a pediatrician, wrote a book, The Happiest Baby on the Block, and he spoke very positively about swaddling and why you should do it, you know. And then, you know, companies started to, I think, you know, realize that there was a real opportunity there to, you know, re-educate the mums out there, and well, the parents out there, on swaddling and why it's, you know, beneficial to their babies.
Why is it beneficial to their babies? I understand that it's at least designed to increase the quality and the length of sleep, but how?
Well, it's babies, when they're first born, they have this thing called the startle reflex, or the Morrow reflex. And what it is basically is that they have no control over their arms and legs. So they can be sound asleep but have this reflex, and obviously the jerking motion will wake them up. So swaddling prohibits that, so that when they're sleeping and they have this reflex, if they're swaddled securely, then they're not going to jerk themselves awake from asleep.
There are concerns, by at least anecdotally, of mothers who are worried about restricting the movement mm-hmm. of their children. And there's something called, you know, the so-called fourth trimester, which is the belief that, you know, babies, there are three trimesters to pregnancy, mm-hmm. but that there's a fourth trimester that maybe they could have baked a little longer in the womb, and swaddling replicates that to some degree. But after that, I think mothers are concerned about the restriction of the movement. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. Well, muslin is, you know, why that's such a great fabric to use, is because it does have a natural give in the fabric. And so therefore, you know, the baby can, just from natural movement, the baby will sort of move their body and it will become, you know, a comfortable sort of swaddle for them. That's why I'm not a big fan of products that use Velcro, because once a baby's Velcroed in, they really can't move, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're using a fabric like muslin, which has a natural give, and as they move, the fabric will move with them, so ultimately they'll find their comfort zone, then it is restrictive, yes, but it's not, it's not overly constrictive. And there is a theory out there. I spoke to one of the pediatricians who said there is a boa constrictor effect, where, you know, if you do swaddle them too tightly, then, you know, that's not the ideal, obviously. But that said, a tight swaddle is definitely the better way to go, because you also don't want them wriggling loose. One, because it will stop them sleeping soundly, and two, you know, you don't want loose blankets and things like that in the crib.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Reagan Moya Jones, co-founder of Aiden and Anae, a company that sells muslin swaddle blankets for babies. Aiden and Anae is named after Reagan's first baby, daughter Anae, and after her co-founder's son Aiden. She was unable to find the muslin wraps that were used on her as a baby in Australia. Do you remember when you had your first child and you couldn't find that blanket, that moment when you said, okay, I want to get this off the ground?
Absolutely. What I was doing was having my mum and my sister send over muslin from Australia. But I was actually coming back from a trip from Australia with Anae, and I stopped off at my ex-business partner's house in LA, and we were sitting on her son Aiden's nursery floor talking about how frustrating it was that you couldn't get muslin here. And she said, well, why don't we call one of the companies that do muslin in Australia? And I said, well, no, let's not do that. Because in Australia, it's very utilitarian, or used to be. It's a bit different now. But it was just four white ones in a cellophane pack. And I said to Claudia, well, we can make it beautiful and pretty and put patterns on it. And I said, let's just find a manufacturer and do it ourselves. And then the next thing out of my mouth was, let's call it Aiden and Anae after the kids. And that was really how it was all born.
You were working at The Economist for over 10 years mm-hmm. before you started Aiden and Anae. And when you first started Aiden and Anae, did you think, this will be a hobby on the side and that's why I'm going to keep my job? What was your thinking surrounding doing both simultaneously?
Well, I always wanted to run my own business, but I wasn't the type of person that just had sort of harebrained ideas and just went off on a tangent and did it. Aiden and Anae, when I had the idea, was something that I, from the get-go, I believed could really be a successful business. So the reason I stayed working is because I wasn't prepared to give up my lifestyle by, you know, going from a two-income family to a one-income family. So I took the hard road and decided to work both jobs simultaneously, so it didn't have any impact on my family financially.
And what impact did that have on you personally?
There were many times I questioned that decision. You know, it was to say that the first couple of years building the business whilst I was still working full time at the Economist Group nearly killed me would be a fairly truthful statement. It was tough.
Give me an example of a day in your life during that time when you're at the Economist, you're starting this business, and by the way, you're on your way to giving birth to four kids eventually.
Right. When the real growth of the business started, I had the two girls, and a normal day would be, you know, I would be up at 6:30 with the girls and then out the door to the Economist at about 9 o'clock. I'd be home again at about 6 o'clock. Then I would focus on the girls because, you know, they didn't sign up for mum running a business. So I would, all my time would, when I got home from the Economist, was focusing on the girls. And then they would go to bed at about 8:30, at which point I would sit myself down at the dining room table with my laptop. And there I stayed till, you know, 3-4 in the morning every night to build Aiden and Anae.
When did you find a moment for yourself in all this?
There was no self moments. And, you know, the toll that it takes on you personally, you know, your marriage, your friendships. I have, you know, lost friends along the way because of it, because they just weren't able to understand that I truly didn't have 1 second to pick up the phone. You know, other than my work, my business and my family, I just didn't have time for anything else. So there was definitely no me time, and there continues to be very little me time, quite frankly. There were no meals out. You know, I went from, you know, cooking and, you know, making dinners for my husband and I to, you know, I couldn't even muster up cheese on toast for him, you know. So consequently, we both put on a bit of weight over the time with all the takeout. You know, it really, you know, it sounds ridiculous and dramatic, but it's the absolute truth. You know, I didn't even have time to wash my hair. There was one particular day that will always stay in my memory where, you know, I was coming home from work at the Economist. dressed and I was on the train and I made a, I think I hadn't washed my hair for 2 weeks. And I thought to myself, tonight, no matter what, I'm going to find time to wash my hair. So fast forward to 3:45 in the morning and I get up from the dining room table and walk into the bathroom and there staring back at me is a tired woman with greasy hair. And that was a huge, you know, huge breaking point that night, you know, where I just thought, what have I done? I've bitten off more than I can chew here. I can't even wash my own hair anymore. This is ridiculous. So there were many moments like that where I really did question what I was doing and whether I'd made the right decision to start the business.
So in that moment when you crumbled in front of the mirror, did mm-hmm. you say, forget it? Or, you know what, this is just natural. I'm overtired and I'm going to wake up in the morning and continue doing this.
No, that... Right then I wanted it all to go away, you know, I just thought I can't do this anymore, you know, and then I went to bed in tears and I woke up the next morning and shook myself off and just kept going.
Incidentally, if you don't wash your hair for a few days, it does look better.
14 days is pretty much the limit, though. It was not good.
So in addition to just being nonstop in that whole time, talk to me about the early days of raising capital.
My ex-business partner and I, we put in our own money to start with to get our first purchase order going. And from memory, it was about $15,000. So that was savings. I distinctly remember my husband saying to me, what the hell are you doing? Where's your business plan? Where I'm like, I don't need a business plan. I just know this is going to be worthwhile. So that was an interesting conversation in the Moya Jones household that night. I won, thank goodness. Our growth was lightning speed from the day we went on the market. You know, the first store we ever went into is a store here in New York called the Upper Breast Side. And within days of us dropping off the stock that we did drop off, we were getting phone calls that it had sold through and they needed more.
And it's called the Upper Breast Side because it's a store dedicated towards moms who are breastfeeding.
That's correct. And I was a customer before I was a vendor supplying the store.
So she runs out of your product and what happens?
She called me and another, again, I remember another pivotal moment in the journey of building this business. And she just said to me, Reagan, that product you dropped off 3 days ago, we've sold through it. You know, you need to hold on to your hat because you're in for a wild ride. And she was right. The same thing happened in Los Angeles where my business partner was. I flew over there to go door-to-door with her to stores as well. Same thing, the few stores that we got it into, you know, within a week were calling for reorders.
I'm Jessica Harris and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Reagan Moya Jones, co-founder of Aiden NNA. We'll hear more from Reagan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Reagan Moya Jones, co-founder of Aiden NNA, a company that sells muslin swaddle blankets for babies. Swaddling, which means wrapping a baby firmly in a blanket, is designed to increase the length and quality of a baby's sleep. The practice has existed for thousands of years, and Reagan was swaddled as a baby in Australia in the 1960s. She started the company in 2004 after she was unable to find muslin wraps for her newborn daughter in the United States. Reagan is also the author of a book called Swaddle Love and the founder of the Swaddle Love Foundation, which aims to prevent touch deprivation in orphanages. You mentioned your ex-partner. Did that end well or not so well?
No, it ended very badly, unfortunately. And, you know, it was obviously made worse by the fact that we were good friends. And so the friendship is no longer as well. So that was, you know, definitely one of the low points in the business. And, you know, luckily I found a way to buy her out and continue on with the business, but it was very touch and go there for a while.
Was it touch and go from the inception? Did you have a sense that, you know what, maybe this is not the best marriage from the beginning, or did you not realize that until a few years into the partnership?
No, initially we were very much on the same page. You know, we came at it from very different angles. You know, Claudia was, you know, quite well off financially, whereas my husband and I, not so much. So there was a lack of balance there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that wasn't, in hindsight, that was not an ideal because, you know, she had the funds to be able to continue to put money into the business. Mm-hmm. And as much as I tried to keep up with her, you know, equally, because that was what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. the business was just growing so quickly that, you know, in a very short period of time, we needed more money than Marcos and I were able to actually put in ourselves. So we then started to borrow money from her family and, you know, paying interest and everything like that. But I think what happened was there was a discomfort with the fact that they were effectively funding the business and I wasn't able to do so. And I think that was sort of the beginning of the end.
So how did it end? Logistically,
I got an email from my friend and partner saying that she didn't believe in the business the way that I did, and you know, I got a time frame of, you know, how long I had to either, you know, buy her out or alternatively she had the right to buy me out for the same, you know, terms pretty much.
Since she didn't have the same belief in the company, was there ever a moment where you questioned, you know what, like maybe there's something there in her questioning?
No, never. I believed in it 150%, and, you know, and it was very tough to keep the business and to, you know, to find the funds to buy Claudia out. But I just dug my heels in and I thought, I've worked too hard to let anyone take this away from me.
Did you think of changing the name of the company since Aiden and Anae is both her son and your daughter Anae?
I didn't. I really didn't because, you know, even though it did end badly and it was extremely upsetting that it ended the way it did, you know, Claudia did found the company with me and was there initially with me. And, you know, Anae and Aiden were absolutely the impetus for the business. So to me, it didn't make any sense to change the name.
How did you gather the funding to buy out your partner?
Well, again, you know, with everything that's happened with my business, I believe in karma. I believe in serendipitous moments, and I had friends who had seen what I was doing with the business and, you know, quite frankly believed in me and where the business was going. So it was only a matter of a few phone calls and I had all the money I needed to actually, you know, buy Claudia out at what she'd asked for.
Along this ride, you're having more and more children. Mm-hmm. You have 4 girls now.
I do. I definitely wanted a large family, you know, which is hysterical. All the people who knew me back when I was the girl that was not getting married, not having children, and now here I am with 4, wanting more and running a baby business. So my life definitely didn't turn out the way that I thought it would. But yes, you know, I would love to have more, but I'm old and tired and my doctor won't let me. So, but we are actually, we are looking at possibly adopting a boy, given that we weren't able to have one ourselves.
I'm curious, to what extent did you try to have a boy?
Well, being the type A personality that I am, after I'd had my second daughter, and I hope my third daughter never hears this, I did actually buy the books on how to choose the sex of your baby. And, you know, we did crazy things like I had my husband drinking espresso shots at 3 a.m. But so I did it to the letter of the law in terms of what the book said to do. But lo and behold, Arin was born and we were a family with 3 daughters. And just for the record, I wouldn't swap her for anything in the world.
Oh, so. Of course.
But but there is a lot of estrogen going on in our household. So, you know, I feel that we kind of need to sort of even it out a little bit if we can.
Incidentally, you mentioned you have 4 children, but you are thinking of adopting at some point. And that led you to the world of orphanages. And you have started a foundation called the Swaddle Love Foundation, which aims to help children in orphanages, specifically to prevent touch deprivation. What is touch deprivation?
Studies now show that if a child is not held or touched enough within the first 2 years of their life, then it's going to be detrimental to their development mentally, physically, emotionally. And sadly, in orphanages, just due to the lack of staff there to help the children and the babies, a lot of babies are left alone in cribs for 19, 20 hours a day and, you know, and never held and never touched. And when I found out about this, I went looking for an organisation that was specifically focused on alleviating this or helping this horrible, heart-wrenching situation. And I couldn't find one. So Swaddle Love Foundation was born. It's about making sure that orphanages are staffed with enough people so that the babies aren't, you know, a victim to touch deprivation.
You mentioned that there are physical results of lack of touch. What are the physical results?
You know, it's things like growing up, being worried about, you know, having difficulty being touched and held, that sort of thing, you know. ADD and things like that, they've linked back to, you know, not having enough physical touch when you were young. They've even got it so far, much detail on it now that scientists have seen that the brains of children who have not been held and touched in the early years of their lives are smaller than the brain of a healthy child that has been held and touched in the early years of their life. So it is significant.
Also, there's a lack of crying that goes on with babies who haven't been touched. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because, quite frankly, they just learn not to cry because no one's coming anyway.
And Aidan and Anae contributes a portion of the profits to the foundation?
That's correct. And also the royalties that I make from the book, I donate, you know, a percentage of that to the foundation as well.
So your company is growing off the charts. You've tripled growth in the last year.
We've had triple-digit growth ever since the inception of the company.
Right. So, and this is all starting with $15,000. But despite that growth, how has your cash situation been?
In September 2009, having just left the Economist Group in May 2009, I was approached by a large company in the baby industry who were interested in buying Aidan and Anae. So I actually got quite far down the road with them in terms of selling the company. You know, they ended up making me an offer that was very nice. And, you know, I at one point I actually did say yes. And then I remember waking up in bed one night and just thinking to myself, I can't do this. I haven't even begun to do what I know in my heart I can do with this business. And so that was not a fun call I had to make to the CEO of that company. But he was incredibly gracious, and I did say to him that if and when Aidan and Anae is ever for sale, I promise he'd be the first person that I'd call. And then after I said that I was pulling out of the sale, I went, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do now? Because I needed money. I owed millions to my manufacturer, and I didn't know where I was going to get the money from. I'd tapped out all friends and family, you know, who had basically, that was how I'd got to that point in the business. I'd just borrowed off friends and family, you know. And I'd been approached by a few private equity firms over the past year. I never felt good about any of them. I never really felt like they were right. Mm-hmm. And I did go back to one of them, and at the same time I went back to them, a new opportunity popped up, which came about from my godson's father knowing these people in the private equity world. And it was just one of those situations where he happened to mention me to them, and it all worked out. Seidler Equity Partners, and we're like a rounding error to them in terms of the size of companies that they would normally invest in. Mm-hmm. I actually had better offers on the table from other private equity firms, but chose them over the others because I just felt that they were the right partners for Aidan and Anae, and they haven't let me down yet. So,
and they allowed you to keep control of the company.
Absolutely,
too.
And that was really key.
Where are the blankets manufactured?
We manufacture in China. Nobody knew how to manufacture muslin. And I actually, again, how I found the manufacturer was, you know, Claudia and I came up with the idea of Aidan and Anae, and then we were like, well, how do we get it manufactured, you know? So we didn't know. I'd made a number of calls. And then one day when I was at The Economist on the reception desk, there was a copy of Women's Wear Daily. And I, because I'm interested in clothes, I picked it up and I was flipping through through it back at my desk, and there was a full page ad for a textile show in New York. So I just sort of, you know, dog-eared it and thought, I'm going to go to that. And it was about 3 days later. So I wandered down there with my piece of muslin and walked to every vendor there, every stall there, all of whom said no until the very last person that I stopped to talk to. And I said, can you manufacture this product or this fabric? And he said, I don't know what it is, but I work for one of the largest manufacturers in China. Let me take it back. 2 weeks later, I got an email saying, yes, we can do it. And that was how we found our manufacturer.
Why is it so hard? It's just a piece of cotton.
Well, yes, it's... I honestly don't know why so many people didn't know what it was or where it was, because, you know, there are a lot of factories that do manufacture muslin, a lot of them copying Aidin and Anae now, because we've had quite a few copycats pop up on the market. So very frustrating, but people tell me I should be flattered, but I never am. I'm just annoyed. So, you know, obviously there's quite a few factories that manufacture muslin, but it was hard to find one.
And muslin swaddle blankets have been around, as we discussed before, for thousands of years. So mm-hmm. don't they still exist in the Middle East? And
I'm not sure. I know Brazil is very familiar with muslin. Australia, you know, that was the thing. In Australia, you didn't have a baby and not use muslin. The UK, very familiar with muslin, but they use it for burp, small pieces for burp cloths and things like that. They don't wrap their babies in it. They do now because we've gone into the UK, you know, as well. So now they're familiar with Aidin and Anae.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Reagan Moya Jones, co-founder of Aidin and Anae, a company that sells muslin swaddle blankets for babies. Swaddling is the practice of wrapping a baby firmly in a blanket, and it originated in the Middle East almost 7,000 years ago. You're from Australia. Mm-hmm. What brought you to the United States?
It was actually my husband, who wasn't my husband at the time. He used to work for Telstra, which is the equivalent of AT&T, I guess, in the US, a huge telecommunications company. And he was brought over here to help set up the US office. So,
and he's from Chile.
He's Chilean, that's right, yes. So although we met in Australia and he was raised, I think he moved to Australia when he was 7 or something like that. So he looks very Latin but sounds like me.
Mm. What did your parents do in Australia?
My dad was in sales and marketing for Pfizer for many, many years in pharmaceuticals, and I actually was in pharmaceuticals before I left to come to the US as well. And my mum is a bookkeeper who now actually works for Aidin and Anae in Australia.
And where does the type A fire under your belly come from in you?
I, you know, definitely more my dad. But, you know, I take it to a whole new level. So, yeah.
You've seemed to have a charmed existence since launching Aidin and Anae, except for, you know, maybe the hiccup with your co-founder. Mm-hmm. What are some other examples of things that didn't necessarily go your way from the beginning?
We have been extremely lucky, and I put that down to a phenomenally good product that, you know, once mothers hear about it and use it, then the product just speaks for itself. And, you know, it's worth mentioning too that we never advertised the product. Like the whole growth of Aidin and Anae came from word of mouth, that just mothers used it, who told more mothers. And consequently, I was a big proponent of giving the product away in the early stages, and still do give a lot away, much to the horror of now the people that I have working with me. So I have been very lucky, you know, in terms of the way the business has gone. So the main issue, you know, besides the horrible experience with my ex-partner, is the working capital issue. You know, it was just so frustrating that the banks, you know, although, you know, we were just a phenomenally successful business, you know, and they just kept slamming the doors in my faces. And it was, you know, and had I not had the ability to go to family and friends, the business would never have survived.
How much did you end up borrowing ultimately from family and friends?
Over the course of probably just over $1 million, I think. And it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
You know, we were always robbing Peter to pay Paul, sort of thing. So it was very frustrating. And quite honestly, until Seidler came in, a majority of my time as the CEO of the company was just spent trying to stay afloat from a funding perspective.
You didn't do any advertising. It was all through word of mouth. Were there any specific people people who in the early days used it that helped other people use it?
Well, yes. About a week after we were on the market, someone called me and said, "Rags, my gosh, open Us Weekly." And there's this huge full page picture of Adam Sandler and his new wife walking down Malibu Beach with their baby draped in Aiden and Anae. And that was the start of the celebrity press, which is just, you know, now, you know, Sandra Bullock, Julia Roberts, you know, Gwen Stefani, Naomi Watts, you know, anyone and everyone seems to use it, which is, you know, it's always fun to see your product out there. And we got lucky because it is a product that is out there. You know, people who do skincare lines, you know, I'm sure lots of celebrities use the products, but you're not seeing them use it. Whereas with us, you know, we joke and we call them a paparazzi shield. That's another use for the product because they're always hiding their babies under Aiden and Anae wrap. So that certainly helped from a PR perspective. So,
and you mentioned before that your husband, you know, wasn't too happy in the early days of getting the business off the ground. Food wasn't on the table. You certainly had your attention diverted elsewhere. You were exhausted. But when did he ultimately start supporting what you were doing?
I could not have this business today without my husband. Quite frankly, I would have left me. Yeah. I don't know why he's still here, but he is, and I'm very lucky that he is. And, you know, I just think he saw the passion and he knew. And actually, when it all went so horribly wrong with my partner, you know, I said to my husband, "What do you think I should do?" And he said, "I think you should fight." He said, "Because I know you. If you, you know, just sort of lay down and give up, you'll never forgive yourself. But if you fight, and even if you fail, you'll know that you gave it your absolute best shot, and, you know, and you can go to bed at night with a peaceful mind." And so he's incredibly supportive, and, you know, that you couldn't run a business like this without a supportive partner.
And you now have a fourth daughter who you swaddle every night with Aiden in an Anae blankets.
Absolutely.
Are they working, or are they
becoming
loose in the
good.
Crib?
No, she's good. She's sleeping through the night. So, you know, she stirs a little bit and you just give her a little bit of a pat and she goes off to sleep again. So we're lucky.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Regan Moya-Jones, co-founder of Aiden and Anae.
Coming up, we'll meet David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart, an organization that connects college students and community volunteers with preschool children from low-income communities for 1 year of mentoring and tutoring. Students from more than 60 colleges, including Stanford, Boston University, Georgetown, Emory, and Barnard, have teamed up with preschool children in the most at-risk neighborhoods with the hopes of tackling America's literacy problem. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm a pleasure to be here.
Where did the idea for Jumpstart come from initially?
So the original group of founders from Jumpstart worked at a place called Ramapo for Children. This is a residential summer camp in Rhinebeck, New York, which is unique in that it's got a one-to-one staff-to-camper ratio. The staff are college students who come to work incredibly hard with mostly inner-city children with a wide range of behavioral learning and emotional problems.
Then how did you then take that idea and say, okay, we want to expand this nationally?
We really struggled with the idea of how do you get this same type of individualized attention for low-income populations in the communities in which the children lived, but really be able to do it anywhere, not just as a residential summer camp, and really focus on language and literacy development. My co-founder was at Yale, Aaron Lieberman, and we started talking with Ed Ziegler, who was one of the national founders of Head Start under the Johnson administration. And he was very bullish on the idea and thought that if we started training and selecting college students to work with 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds in low-income communities, that we could really have a demonstrable gain in school readiness skills for this population?
We take for granted that the foundation for success is established before kindergarten. And you have organizations like the Harlem Children's Zone, run by Jeffrey Canada, and Jumpstart, which was co-founded by you, addressing that assumption. Where did that come from? Why have we developed that assumption or fact now that the pre-kindergarten years are the most essential years?
It's a lot of studies that have been done that show that 80% of your IQ is determined by the time that you're 5 years old, that the most important skill for children to have in school is a basic literacy by the time you're in third grade. And there's a huge difference between low-income preschool populations versus their middle and upper income peers. And we figured if we can intervene at the earliest possible moment, that we could close this achievement gap between these two different populations. And that was really the need that we saw that we wanted to address with Jumpstart.
So your co-founder, Aaron Lieberman, is a student at Yale, and you're a student at Harvard. How did you go about logistically making it happen?
Well, to be fair, there was a somewhat of a wider founding group, including a great woman named Rebecca Weintraub, a great guy named Jordan Moranis. The way we started is by sitting in our college dining halls and saying, hey, would you like to read with a preschool child today? We teamed up with a great preschool center called Jamaica Plain Head Start. And pretty early on, when we started connecting college students with children at Jamaica Plain Head Start, we saw the same types of things that we had seen when we were bunk counselors at Ramapo Anchorage Camp happen in this preschool center in a very poor area of Boston. And that was children who came to us who didn't even know how to hold on to a book. Mm-hmm. Over the course of not months, but even just weeks, could sit down quietly with their Jumpstart core member, who was the college student from Harvard at that time, and start reading books like The Very Hungry Caterpillar, start doing activities to bring those books alive, and really take an interest in literacy from the age of three.
We talk about Jumpstart having a focus on literacy, but these children coming from these low-income communities, you know, often have emotional neglect and other psychological issues because they don't have the support coming from, you know, very functional parents all the time. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you dealt with those issues and what those were?
Sure. Our belief was we weren't going to take a professional mental health approach to this. None of our college students that we recruited and trained had that background. But we did think that if you get a highly enthusiastic and well-trained college student to work with a 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old, that they would blossom not just because they started to take an interest in books, but because they had somebody who they felt like really cared for them. And they had a fantastic role model for somebody that they might become.
What were some of the frustrations that you faced?
I think that the one-on-one connection generally worked. It's a matchmaking process. There were certainly times where a core member would come for a Jumpstart session and the child simply would not want to be with them. They were scared. They didn't warm up to that core member for sometimes several days and even weeks. We never really had a situation where eventually the breakthrough didn't happen, but it could often take time.
And how many students were you focusing on in Boston in the first year or two?
So the first year, when I was still in college, busy writing a senior thesis and taking college courses, we had 15 college students working with 15 preschool children. We built that up over time, so we basically doubled every year. And then when we were able to do this full time, thanks to something called an Echoing Green Fellowship for public service entrepreneurs, we could really build that growth rate even more.
Incidentally, you mentioned Echoing Green. They're an organization that supports social entrepreneurs by providing them with some financing, among other things.
Yeah, financing, definitely. But also they bring them together for a seminar on how do you create something from scratch. It was partially the technical assistance that they gave us, how you apply for your 501c3 status, how you do the bookkeeping and raise money and other things. But really, it was the example that they showed, the fact that we were in a support network of other social entrepreneurs, many of whom were in Boston, and that we could really reach out to, because it's as being an entrepreneur is incredibly exciting, and it can be fairly lonely as well. A lot of my classmates who were at investment banks or at consulting firms, while they didn't have the excitement of starting something on their own, they did have a structure and support network that we just didn't have. We were on a high wire without a net underneath.
So talk to me about the process of going from one or two colleges, and at the time it was Harvard and Yale students participating in this, to now more than 60. How did you think about that?
There was definitely a huge amount of tension in both the early days and as we started to grow more rapidly between the idea that you should really start very slowly, perfect the model, and then try to roll it out over time, versus those who felt like we could build the airplane while flying it. I remember when I did my thesis, senior thesis at Harvard, there was the idea between the hold and harvest, which is the go slow approach, versus the fixes fail, which is grow and you'll figure out as you're doing it. My own feeling is that you have to build the aircraft while you're flying it, that with scale comes opportunity, and you have to get to that scale even if you haven't figured out every detail of the program. We also tried to involve some real thought leaders in the space. So there was a guy named Jeff Braddock, who was a professor at Harvard Business School. He had spent most of his time thinking about how for-profit franchisees grow, bagel stores and donut shops. But he really used his brain power along with a board that we developed to think about how do we bring this nationally. And really the best way for us to do that was to reach out to colleges and universities to let them know about Jumpstart, but that they would actually apply to Jumpstart and we would help them start on their campus.
How did you support yourself in the early days?
I lived with some dear friends in an old haunted house in Somerville, Massachusetts, where I was paying $300 a month in rent. And that actually seemed like pretty decent living to me. When I first became an Echoing Green Fellow and Aaron and I launched this, we were both making $15,000 a year. And we begged a real estate developer named Danny Levin to give us donated office space, which he did. It was a small three-room office that had tons of mice running around, so we never felt like we were alone. And we sort of begged and scraped our way into forming this organization. We wanted there to be some sort of brand recognition of Jumpstart at some point. So we designed our own logo, which is very similar to the logo that Jumpstart still uses today. Two circles with hands holding a book to show the one-on-one interaction around reading. And we called around to find the cheapest place that we could get t-shirts printed. We ended up with a place in Waltham, Massachusetts called Just Say Rock. And I remember going out there to pick up the t-shirts because, God forbid, we should pay a delivery fee. And we were the only t-shirt that was not a black t-shirt with a Megadeth logo on the front of it at this particular t-shirt place. So those early days certainly lead to some interesting experiences.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart, an organization that connects college students and community volunteers with preschool children from low-income communities for 1 year of mentoring and tutoring. David co-founded Jumpstart while he was a student at Harvard College, and he's gone on to work in various fields of finance and stem cell research. 1999, you had a personal setback. It was between Jumpstart and Stanford Business School where you had an accident that left you paralyzed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
After I'd gotten into Stanford Business School, I was traveling in Latin America and was paralyzed in a diving accident. It was definitely the first time where I'd felt like I'd had a significant obstacle in my path. And although my parents had been divorced when I was in high school, I really led a pretty blessed existence. But this was definitely having to learn how to live life in a new body. And that takes its own sense of entrepreneurship to figure out how to take care of your daily activities in a new situation. I was had to use a wheelchair. I had no movement or sensation below my chest and only partial use of my hands.
Here you have this series of successes with Jumpstart going well. You get into Stanford Business School, and then you have this big setback in 1999. Do you feel like you perhaps weren't able to handle it as well because you had been used to a charmed life to some extent? Like, how do you reconcile that?
I think a lot of the response to paralysis is based just strictly on personality, and I guess I have a good thing going because I'm pretty darn stubborn. And I happen to just have a very optimistic view on life. And so the process of adjusting, while not easy at all, was something that I was fairly well prepared for. On the other hand, you know, the feelings of loss and of frustration were definitely new to me. And dealing with those and trying to incorporate that into my life and to feel like I could move on even when so many of the things that had been so simple before now were so difficult is something that I had to adjust to and frankly I still have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
And how did it impact the decisions that you made, whether it be personal or professional, if at all?
I think the biggest one for me professionally, I was lucky. I wasn't a lumberjack or a dancer, something that was my career had to change because of my physical situation. I felt like I could still be an entrepreneur. I definitely got a lot more interested in the healthcare field, something that I spent a lot of time on when I was at Stanford Business School, when I was working in the Treasury Department under Secretary Paul O'Neill, and that I decided to do when I got part of the when I was part of the Prop 71 campaign. The Prop 71 campaign was really a grassroots movement from the patient advocacy community, started by a really visionary guy named Bob Klein, who had a son with type 1 diabetes. And between other parents of kids with type 1 diabetes, people like Michael J. Fox and Christopher Reeve, we created a coalition of people who could really advocate for an alternative national program in stem cell research. It just happened to be located in the state of California, where you can take advantage of the unique brand of democracy where 600,000 signatures gets anything you want on the ballot. So we had taken the restrictions that had been put on in the Bush administration on federal funding and created an opportunity in the state of California to push research ahead in this very vital field.
Is there any sense that stem cell research could help your ailment?
There are definitely people who feel like one day it may have applicability towards spinal cord injury. That wasn't my personal motivation. I sort of come to be comfortable in life in a wheelchair and feel like I'm pretty lucky given where I am. My situation is stable and I'm not like, unfortunately, many others who are in are dealing with a disease or a condition in which it's really degenerative. Mm-hmm. So I really thought of it for future patients, people who might not have to live through this, a lot of the same circumstances that I have, or different diseases, rather than my own situation.
You are married now. You have twins.
Yes, I do.
And you've moved on to now the field of asset management and finance. What role does Jumpstart play in your life now?
Jumpstart plays still a huge role in my life. You know, professionally, I've now started a new organization, and the experience of having started Jumpstart, even though I'm in a very different field, feels very familiar. The early days of trying to form a team, make clear vision, and to execute on that is very similar from those early days of being in my dorm room. On the family front, I now have twins, a boy and a girl, who are starting to learn to read. And that is so exciting for me, because we spend probably an hour a day, whether it's 5 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the evening, where I get to spend time going through books with them. And that is just one of the great pleasures in my life. And I hear my daughter, when she does wake us up at 5 o'clock in the morning, saying, polar bear, what do you hear in our bed while we're trying to getting her back to sleep?
David, thank you very much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Jessica.
My guest has been David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart.
To learn more about the show, visit our website at FromScratchRadio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.